Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on President Harry S. Truman and the Korean War. Picking up the story with Truman's decision to send in ground troops to South Korea to aid the South Koreans in their battle against North Korea, to be led by General Douglas MacArthur. Secretary of State Dean Acheson backed President Truman's decision to send U.S. ground troops to Korea, stating, "It would be a great disaster if we were to lose now, and it is essential to give the commander on the spot whatever he needs to stop a disaster." Acheson insisted that U.S. soldiers be given the right to fight Soviet forces if they were encountered there. He said they must have the right to defend themselves. According to the official record, everybody agreed. The Secretary of State said he was convinced that the Russians do not intend to enter directly into the Korean dispute. Consulted about offers of naval support and airplanes from U.S. allies, President Truman ordered, "Take everything. We may need them." Truman complained that just as in World War II, it was hard to get information out of General Douglas MacArthur, and he directed his aide, Lewis Johnson, to ask MacArthur for daily reports on the fighting in Korea. Truman had no quarrel with anybody and didn't intend to have one. He just wanted to know what the facts were, and he said, "I don't want any leaks." The president had never met the legendary Douglas MacArthur, but he did not trust him. As early as 1945, Truman had complained in his diary about Mr. Prima Donna, Brass Hat, Five-Star MacArthur. "Don't see how a country that can produce such men as Robert E. Lee, John J. Pershing, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and Omar Bradley, and at the same time produce Custers, Pattons, and MacArthurs." Nor was Truman charmed when MacArthur, as a sitting general, flirted with running against him for president back in 1948. The White House press aide, Eben Ayers, recorded Truman's belief that MacArthur was a supreme egotist who regards himself as something of a god. After John Foster Dulles called on Truman that week, the president confided to Ayers that the Republican diplomat had told him that when word came to Tokyo of the outbreak in Korea, MacArthur, who was there, knew nothing of it, and the general staff was afraid to tell him. Thus, Dulles had done so himself. Truman told Ayers that Dulles was proposing that MacArthur be hauled back to the United States, but he reminded the visitor that MacArthur was popular among Republicans. The president had told Dulles that he could not recall MacArthur without causing a tremendous reaction in this country where he has been built up to a heroic stature. At Truman's direction, the Joint Chiefs cabled the general with permission to use ground forces in Korea. At the president's direction, they carefully warned MacArthur that their message does not constitute a decision to engage in war with the Soviet Union if Soviet forces intervene in Korea. The decision regarding Korea, however, was taken in full realization of the risks involved. "If Soviet forces actively oppose our operations in Korea, your forces should defend themselves, should take no action to aggravate the situation, and you should report the situation to Washington." After inspecting the South Korean battlefront, MacArthur warned the Joint Chiefs of Staff on Friday, June 30, 1950, stating, "The Korean Army had coastal forces are in confusion, have not seriously fought, and lack leadership. They are incapable of gaining the initiative over such a force as that embodied in the North Korean Army." The general's diplomatic advisor in Tokyo, William Sibbald, cabled Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, that Musio was reporting from Seoul, Korea, a desperate and rapidly deteriorating situation. He had spent most of night and practically all day with top Koreans and feels he can hold them in line a little longer. Danger, however, is that they might soon panic. He strongly urged all-out effort before situation out of hand. At 3:40 in the morning, Washington time on June 30th, General Collins and others spoke by telephone with MacArthur, who complained that the Joint Chiefs' cable of the previous evening did not give him sufficient latitude. MacArthur warned them, stating, "Time is of the essence. Clear-cut decision is imperative." After the conversation, Collins alerted the Secretary of the Army, Frank Pace, who called the president at Blair House at 5 o'clock. Truman had been awake for half an hour and had just shaved. Told by Pace that MacArthur wanted two divisions of ground troops for Korea, Truman immediately said yes, later scrawling in his diary that the force was to be used at max discretion. General Collins telephoned MacArthur that he could start by moving one regimental combat team into the Korean forward combat area, stating, "You will be advised later as to further buildup." Collins added, "We all have full confidence in you and your command." Truman asked Pace and Lewis Johnson, his aide, to consider accepting two divisions offered by Chiang Kai-shek, noting that Nationalist China was a permanent member of the UN Security Council. He wrote in his journal stating, "Since Britain, Australia, Canada, and the Netherlands have come in with ships and planes, we probably should use the Chinese ground forces. What will that do to Mao Tse-tung, we don't know. Must be careful not to cause a general Asiatic war. Russia is figuring on an attack in the Black Sea and towards the Persian Gulf. Both prizes Moscow has wanted since Ivan the Terrible, who is now their hero with Stalin and Lenin." At an 11 o'clock meeting with department secretaries and congressional leaders in the cabinet room, Truman announced that he would issue a brief new public statement that "General MacArthur has been authorized to use certain supporting ground units in Korea, and he was acting under the auspices of the United Nations." Tom Connally, Truman's aide, praised the president for allowing U.S. forces to range north of the 38th parallel when necessary, the 38th parallel being the dividing line between North and South Korea. General Omar Bradley explained, stating, "Sometimes the most effective way to hit your enemy is to go after his bases." Senator John Gurney of South Dakota said he hoped Truman understood that now that they were in this war, there could be no backing down. The president replied, "I certainly do." Senator Wiley asked if Truman thought the Chinese communists would now aid the North Koreans. The president said he had no intelligence on that subject yet, but there were a lot of rumors flying around that Mao's army would fight. Congressman John Vers, Republican from Ohio, urged Truman to get some Asiatic peoples in the fighting to help us, not just other white people, so that it wouldn't look so much like white man's imperialism. The president warned that if we got some Asiatics, like Chiang's men on Formosa, now called Taiwan, for example, we would have to be awfully careful of the Chinese communists. Then the Senate Minority Leader, Kenneth Wherry of Nebraska, who had opposed U.S. involvement in the United Nations, rose from the cabinet table as if giving a speech and asked if Truman had planned to inform Congress before taking the major step of sending ground troops into Korea. The president replied that he had already dispatched the force, but if there was a real emergency, he would advise the House and Senate. Wherry replied that Congress ought to be consulted before such momentous actions. Truman insisted that the weekend crisis in Korea had been an emergency. "There was no time for lots of talk. I just had to act as commander-in-chief, and I did." Further stating, "I told MacArthur to go to the relief of the Koreans and carry out the instructions of the United Nations Security Council." Senator Wherry stood firm, stating, "I understand the action all right, but I do feel that Congress ought to be consulted before any large-scale actions are taken again." Truman responded that if he took any further such moves, he would tell Congress about it, but made no pledge to ask for consent from the House or Senate in advance. Vice President Alvin Barkley began to discuss a British offer of naval aid in Korea, but Senator Wherry rose again to say he would like the floor. Again, Wherry told the president that he ought to consult Congress before taking drastic steps in Korea. Truman replied that as soon as he had definite information that required action by the Congress, he would so inform its members, stating, "If there is any necessity for congressional action, I will come to you. But I hope we can get those bandits in Korea suppressed without that." Changing the subject, Senator Tidings of Maryland urged the president to seek troops from other countries, if only just a company or two. Rising for a third time, Senator Wherry broke in to say he had been studying Truman's new statement stating the president should not take steps without congressional approval. Breaking the tension in the cabinet room, Congressman Dewey Short, Republican from Missouri, rose to announce that he was expressing the opinion of practically everyone in the Congress by thanking Truman for the quality of his leadership. The president closed with a warning, stating, "This is all very delicate. I don't want it stated any place that I'm telling General MacArthur what to do. He is not an American general now. He is acting for the United Nations. It would spoil everything if we said he was just doing what we tell him to do." After the meeting, still seething over his confrontation with Senator Wherry, Truman received Joseph Kennedy, who was still one of the nation's best-known isolationists, and whose son Jack Kennedy was now a backbencher in the House of Representatives. Joe Kennedy had asked to see the president about relations with the Vatican and Rome, and was surprised that, despite the Korean crisis, Truman was keeping the appointment. As Kennedy later wrote in his diary, the president looked rather cross. Showing his guest to a chair next to his desk, Truman reported that he had just met with members of Congress, including some real stinkers, but all had backed him on Korea. Referring to the North Koreans and the Soviet patrons, he said he was not going to let those sons of bitches push him around. He doubted that the Russians had a geopolitical motive to plunge directly into the Korean struggle, stating, "They are much more interested in the Black Sea and the oil peninsulas and Yugoslavia." As Joe Kennedy later recorded, Truman realized that these are horrible times and that the decisions he is making are going to affect all civilization. Joe Kennedy, who was close to Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, warned the president that his position on Korea reminded him of the moment when Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain of Britain had guaranteed the security of Poland, making a European war almost inevitable. No doubt recalling how Kennedy had endorsed Chamberlain's mollification of Adolf Hitler, Truman shot back that Chamberlain quit at Munich, and that in this Korean crisis, he was not going to appease. Truman added that if the French and British had stood up to Hitler, the Germans would have retreated. Joe Kennedy told him that Americans were worried that we would be bombed and could not be protected. Truman replied, "They are right. They can't be protected, and neither can the Russians. We could drop bombs on Leningrad in Russia tonight." The start of the Korean confrontation was by no means Truman's finest hour. He and Secretary of State Dean Acheson had blundered into this war, which neither man wanted or expected, by leading the Soviets and North Koreans to believe that if South Korea were invaded, the United States might refuse to defend it. Once the war began, contrary to his reputation for plain-spokenness, the president failed to level with Americans about how costly the Korean conflict might ultimately be. He had refused to ask Congress in advance to approve his use of military force in Korea, noting that instead he had asked the United Nations Security Council for authority to do so. But the United Nations Participation Act of 1945, which dictated the terms under which the United States would join the New World Body, required that a president ask permission from Congress before providing armed forces to the United Nations. Nevertheless, in the summer of 1950, a Senate and House that were both dominated by Truman's own Democratic Party, operating in a mood of alarm, made no serious effort to hold the president to the letter of this law on Korea. In July, Truman's aide, George Elsie, reminded his chief that drafts of a resolution by Congress approving the president's response to Korea had been kicking around the White House. But, with his expansive view of presidential authority, Truman told Elsie, stating, "I certainly never would have asked for anything. It was none of Congress's business. If Congress wanted to do it on its own initiative, that would have been all right with me. But I just did what was in my power, and there was no need for any congressional resolution." Thus, Harry Truman became the first president to engage the country in a major foreign conflict, this one potentially risking war with China, without bothering to ask Congress for a war declaration. The Democratic majority in the House and Senate could easily have obtained a declaration for him. But instead, Truman had exponentially cut the legislative branch out of the action at start, unwilling to ask it even for a simple resolution endorsing his decision to use force against North Korea. As a result, Truman had undermined his ability to wage the Korean War, and he established a dangerous example for future American presidents. On Monday, July 3, 1950, during a meeting at Blair House, where Truman was staying during the renovation of the White House, Secretary of State Dean Acheson tried to persuade Truman to address a joint session of Congress, asking for its endorsement of the U.S. military action in Korea. Acheson said he had drafted a joint resolution and tried to avoid anything which would give rise to debate. It would have Congress commend the action by the United States, not by the president, and it would not mention other danger spots in Asia, such as Formosa or Indochina. Truman agreed that he must be very careful not to appear as if he was trying to get around Congress and use extra constitutional powers. But Scott Lucas, his Senate leader, asked why any resolution was necessary since the Korean fighting was now going along well, and the president had very properly done what he had to do without consulting the Congress. Senator Lucas warned Truman that he would be practically asking for a declaration of war. "Exactly the point," replied Truman, who explained, with contrived reasoning, that by sending troops to Korea, he had been acting not as president, but as commander-in-chief of our forces in the Far East. Moreover, Truman noted, the Senate and House were now out of session. Why court trouble by calling them back to Washington, D.C.? Secretary of State Acheson later told his aides that Truman believed that if he asked Congress to approve what he had done, it would weaken the power of the presidency, and we would have to be able to respond quickly in circumstances that are typical of this era. Truman asked Dean Rusk that he liked James Polk because President Polk regularly told Congress to go to hell on foreign policy matters. On Sunday, July 9, 1950, Douglas MacArthur cabled, "The situation in Korea is critical. Despite U.S. efforts to build sufficient force to hold the enemy in Korea, American military opposition to North Korean mechanized units and armor had been ineffective against overwhelming odds of more than 10 to 1. The general reported that the enemy force more and more assumes the aspect of a combination of Soviet leadership and technical guidance with Chinese Communist ground elements." 3 days later, Truman wrote his wife, Bess Truman, "It looks bad in the Far East. We can't get there in force for 3 weeks, and by then it may be too late, or there'll be an explosion someplace else." Referring to his nuclear option, Truman went on, "Hopefully we can contain it and not have to order our terrible weapon turned loose." He recounted to her that under the strain of war, "I lost my temper yesterday and gave old Senate Wiley a tongue-lashing at a conference I was having with 8 senators. 4 weeks after sending U.S. armed forces into Korea, Truman gave no extended explanation of his action to the American people. He was worried about spreading a war psychosis. This was a mistake. By entering a war to save a regime most Americans knew nothing about, in a theater from which he had previously withdrawn U.S. troops, he had left much of the public puzzled, asking why, only 5 years after winning a global war in World War II, the American Goliath was bogged down in a struggle against North Koreans. Korea had shown the vulnerability in America's post-World War II position as the world's overwhelming superpower. Vast global commitments could oblige the nation to engage in all sorts of local wars like Korea's, in which American military dominance did not necessarily provide an advantage. With a lot to explain, Truman opted to present his own televised version of a fireside chat. On Wednesday evening, July 19, 1950, from behind a lectern of the White House movie theater, he told Americans, echoing Roosevelt's language after Pearl Harbor, that the sneak attack on South Korea came without provocation and without warning. The assault had shown, he said, beyond all doubt, that the international communist movement is willing to use armed invasion to conquer independent nations. Truman warned that there may be similar acts of aggression in other parts of the world. We know that the cost of freedom is high, but we are determined to preserve our freedom no matter what the cost. The free nations have learned the fateful lesson of the 1930s. Appeasement leads only to further aggression and ultimately to war. Cautioning that it will take a hard, tough fight to halt the invasion and to drive the communists back, Truman read aloud from an optimistic report he had lately received from General MacArthur. It was a good thing that Truman's reputation for straight talk did not depend on this speech. He gave no hint of the considerable chance that North Korea had taken the offensive because he and Secretary of State Acheson had signaled to Joseph Stalin and Kim Il-sung of North Korea that the United States would not defend the South in a crunch. He claimed instead that the Korean assault was the inevitable, well-planned vanguard of systematic efforts by monolithic communism to invade free nations. Truman's early conduct of his war did not escape criticism from his own party. Lyndon Johnson of Texas, the fast-rising senator, complained that the conflict was being fought piecemeal without full mobilization of American manpower and industry. U.S. troops were being sent to Korea with one arm tied behind their back. Texas Congressman Lloyd Benson demanded that Truman insist that North Korea withdraw from the South within 1 week, or else the North would be subject to atomic attack. In August, General MacArthur showed disturbing signs of insubordination. After the President and Secretary of State Acheson rejected his appeals for a formal military partnership with Chiang Kai-shek, the general publicly wrote the Veterans of Foreign Wars to denounce unnamed exponents of appeasement and defeatism in the Pacific who were arguing that if we defend Formosa, we alienate continental Asia. Acheson advised Truman that MacArthur's message raised the issue as to who is the President of the United States. Truman ordered MacArthur to retract his pronouncement, and MacArthur complied. By the start of September 1950, with U.S. troops and material flowing into Korea, U.N. forces had built a defensive perimeter around Pusan. Touting this achievement in another TV address, Truman told Americans, "For weeks, the enemy has been hammering, now at one spot, now at another. He has been beaten back each time with heavy loss. We believe the invasion has reached its peak. The task remaining is to crush it." MacArthur, with his long experience planning amphibious invasions and liberating the Philippines in World War II, wished to stage a dangerous, spectacular landing on the Korean Peninsula at Incheon. Although well aware of the risk, Truman told him to proceed. Thunder began at dawn on Friday, September 15th, as U.S. forces hurried ashore at Incheon. Within 2 weeks, they had broken the North Korean grip on Seoul and retaken the southern capital. Before the Incheon invasion, the president had approved military operations north of the 38th parallel, but only if the Soviets and China stayed out of the war. Now, General MacArthur extorted him for permission to push northward. Truman knew that the Security Council resolution, in which he placed such heavy stock, had not authorized UN forces to conquer and occupy the North. However, noting that the Soviet delegate had returned to the Security Council, he refused advice to go back to the UN for consent to expand the mission in Korea. Feeling pressure from MacArthur and emboldened by the Incheon victory, Truman asked his new Secretary of Defense, George Marshall, brought out of retirement to wage this war, to wire MacArthur that he should feel unhampered tactically and strategically to proceed north of the 38th parallel. This would mean pushing for a reunited Korea under the aegis of the United States and its allies. On Wednesday, October 11th, Truman boarded the Independence, which flew 315 miles per hour, for a 6,700-mile trip to see General MacArthur on Wake Island, almost two-thirds of the way across the Pacific. The president was not averse to basking in the general's Incheon success, and he wished to size him up. He'd acerbically written to a cousin that he had to talk to God's right-hand man. Truman's aide, Charles Murphy, privately considered the session a public relations stunt. His more rough-edged appointment secretary, Matthew Connolly, groused, "When does a king go to the prince? I think this operation stinks." Reading from Michael Beschloss's essay on Harry Truman and the Korean War will continue. This is Wallace Klunkhamst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.